Hello and welcome to the Ori Spotlight Podcast. We're talking to leaders across the cell and gene therapy industry and telling you more about Ori's mission to manufacture brighter futures. I'm Jason Foster, the CEO of Ori Biotech, and I'll be the host for today's podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Ori Spotlight Podcast. I am your host, Jason Foster. Today, we are lucky to have Joe DePinto with us. Joe is the head of cell and gene advanced therapies at McKesson. Welcome, Joe.
Hi, Jason. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. Whereabouts in the world are you today? I know you live in Florida, so I'm already jealous that your weather's probably better than mine.
I am absolutely at my home in Florida today, heading out for the week of travel for business tomorrow, but I'm fortunate to be here to spend some time with you.
Excellent. Okay. We won't ask about any golf plans later today. We'll just leave those for another discussion. It'd be great if we could start out just a little bit with your background, how you came into the role. Obviously, you've been in the industry for a long time. And we're have been in cell and gene as well for a while. But just tell us a little bit about your journey as a leader in the space.
Yeah. So Jason, it's been an interesting 30-year journey for me here in my career. I've been fortunate enough to be a part of bringing some really unique and innovative and breakthrough products to market in a variety of different companies, and helping patients get access to these products. I've started my career at large multinationals, like spent a significant amount of my time at Johnson & Johnson and companies like Eli Lilly, working in the oncology and targeted therapies area. And then I spent some time at emerging biotech companies like ImClone and Dendrion. And Dendrion was great because I really learned the ins and outs of cell therapy from the beginning, right? With dendritic cells, with Provenge, and some of the challenges of the early supply chain for these groundbreaking type products. And then transition to services and solutions companies and building out a cell and gene vertical in that fashion. Had a nice several year venture capital, digital therapeutic startup experience in Silicon Valley, where I learned a lot about the tech side of the business. And for the last almost 2 years now, I've been really fortunate to be a part of McKesson and building out their vertical in cell and gene therapy and really trying to take a look at how we build a strategy and then execute and operationalize that strategy at a Fortune 10 company, which is really well positioned to make an impact on the cell and gene ecosystem and the value chain. So I'm excited to be here and always good to talk to you. You're so knowledgeable about the space and just really talk about what we need to do to help patients, which is the most important thing.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. I mean, extensive, obviously, experience in all parts of the sector. I remember kind of not that long ago, I think when you and I met, you were at Vannetti working in the COI, COC space. I wonder how that kind of, you know, experience plays into what you're working on, you know, supply chain manufacturing at McKesson.
Yeah. So listen, Vannetti was a great experience. I had an opportunity to work with some really good people in looking at the cell orchestration platform for chain of identity and chain of custody and building out a platform. It's venture-based startup out of the Bay Area. And it was really my first venture into tech. And I learned firsthand the challenges of building a platform. But I also had the unique experience of working with so many emerging biotechs, as well as really working with major pharma companies in an effort to help them bring their products from the clinical phases to commercial phase. And Vannetti engaged late clinical, early commercial. And I learned firsthand some of the challenges in navigating the product journey, as well as the value chain. And it's really been a great experience, good learning experience. And that's where I was fortunate enough to meet the folks at McKesson who were on the board of Vannetti. And upon exiting Vannetti, they quickly contacted me and said, hey, crazy idea here. We're building out a vertical in cell and gene. We'd love you to lead it. So we talked a bit about what that would look like. And what really appealed to me was the diversity of assets at McKesson. And really at this point in my life, the really ability to leave a mark on enabling patients to get access to cell and gene. So that's why I came over, and I'm forever grateful for the experience at Vineti. I learned a lot there, and all the contacts I made along the way at all the different companies trying to commercialize cell and gene therapy.
Yeah, unless you've been living under a rock in healthcare, you certainly know McKesson as a major player in the space. Maybe people will be less familiar with how they operate in the cell and gene or advanced therapy space. So would love to touch on that in just a second, but also just maybe thinking about the orchestration that Vineti and others do and sort of this logistical challenge that particularly autologous cell therapy faces. There's a lot of moving parts. Clearly, it's a circular supply chain, which you've never had to deal with before. It's a living medicine, which adds complexity. What is it, in your view, that these kind of emerging models where, you know, a player like McKesson might get involved? We talk about distributed manufacturing quite a lot, trying to bring manufacturing closer to the patient as a potential solution for some of these challenges. So, you know, how does a company like McKesson think about this and maybe trying to leverage what I would imagine is quite a large footprint and decades of experience as it thinks about these challenges?
Yeah, so first and foremost, you're spot on the complexity of the supply chain and the different moving parts with autologous and matched allo, personalized cancer vaccines, a variety of different flavors that need all different aspects of the supply chain to work differently. And, one of the things that's really important is understanding the complexity that is necessary to be addressed in that supply chain and how to scale it is really important for the biotech companies or the pharma companies that are working in the space and being able to solution through partners, right? This all can't be done by the company on its own. It's understanding how to use partners to leverage some of the solutioning needed to overcome some of those barriers. That's how we set out to develop our strategy for cell and gene here at McKesson. Is we looked at the patient journey, the product journey, and the reimbursement journey, and where were the pain points along the way, and how were the McKesson assets deployed to address those pain points, alleviate those pain points for our biopharma customers, for providers who really are challenged at this point in time with the sheer volume that's coming through their sites. And the payers, always with the patient as an overarching theme, right? Making sure that we clearly understood the patient and caregiver needs, because that's paramount. That's paramount to how we make decisions in how we build our business here.
Well, let's go a layer down, if you don't mind, around the McKesson strategy. I'd be super interested to know how you're thinking about, you know, some of these challenges in cell and gene. You know, obviously, well, I don't know if it's true that they started there, but many will know McKesson as a distributor, as a service provider to the pharma industry, also in the specialty pharmaceutical space. So it's expanded its business quite significantly. When you look at the challenges in advanced therapies, how are you as McKesson thinking about, you know, leveraging assets that you already have or building new assets to try and solve some of these challenges?
Yeah. Great question. And I think many people see McKesson as a distributor, a wholesaler, and McKesson is actually quite more diverse than that. It's a diversified healthcare company. But yes, traditionally, as we think about the supply chain, McKesson has some unique assets that can address the cell and gene space around distribution, around logistics, and around patient access, right? That's sort of the core of how these cell and gene therapies get in the commercial phase to the patient, right? As they transition out from clinical trials to day-to-day commercial product, really need to understand how revenue is recognized, how the product is shipped from manufacturers, when does it get recognized, how is it tracked, how do we do benefit verification, benefit approval to ensure reimbursement. All of that is a really coordinated and should be a well-orchestrated effort, right? Enable for us to take these really breakthrough scientific therapies and really bring them at scale to patients. We really need to understand how all that works. The benefit of a company like McKesson is we have all these assets, and you can use them individually, or you can use them in an integrated fashion, depending upon what the individual needs of the large farmer or emerging biotech is. Mm. If you want a best-in-class specialty pharmacy, then sure, we have that with biologics. If you want an integrated approach where you use our 3PL, our specialty pharmacy, and our hub, we're one of the unique assets available that can package it all together for an emerging biotech. So they have one point of contact to go to. And then we as the organization would need to coordinate with partners in the ecosystem, whether that be CDMOs, manufacturers, as well as payers, in an effort to make sure that these products are streamlined in their product journey and patient journey so that the patient gets access to the product.
Yeah, I mean, this is certainly in the wheelhouse of what McKesson's been doing for decades in trying to facilitate access. So, I mean, one of the assets in the McKesson network is US Oncology or US Oncology Network. I was listening to the Legend earnings call recently, and their CEO mentioned that 30% of the patients who were participating, and I think it was the CARTITUDE 4 trial, were getting dosed in the community, which I was surprised about and happy to hear. Obviously, you know, community-based care would help, you know, improve access to for what is pretty much a specialist. You know, there's only a small number usually of specialist centers that are able to deliver cell therapy, at least today. And I wonder what, you know, either McKesson's work with US Oncology or other type of community organizations, how might that help improve access, and what other types of services are you out there providing today?
Yeah, we're really fortunate here at McKesson as a diversified healthcare company to have some unique patient forward assets like US Oncology. It is geographically dispersed asset that has, I think last I checked, somewhere between 450 and 500 sites in the United States in 30 plus states, right? Mm-hmm. So it's geographically dispersed. It's a community-based, very sophisticated oncology, hematology treatment center, and sees a quite large volume of the U.S. The U.S. commercial community-based treatment occurs at U.S. Oncology. And that's a great resource to have in the McKesson family. And as you clearly stated and accurately stated, we're starting to see more and more of cell and gene therapy in the United States move from academic setting to more community setting, as there's pressure on providers. And those provider pressures are at the academic centers that are typically the qualified treatment centers or the QTCs. Mm-hmm. They're doing clinical trials. They're doing commercial patients. And quite frankly, there's just not enough room at the sites to deliver care. So they're looking at the academic outpatient clinics, and they're also looking at their community hospitals within their systems to migrate to use more of those sites as qualified treatment centers. And it has a benefit for patients, right? As I see it, the best care for a lot of the patients in the cell and gene space is local care, right? These patients don't want to travel 50 to 75 miles for an extended period prior to getting their cell and gene therapy. And then after follow-up for their cell and gene therapy, it's an impact on the patient and their caregivers, quite frankly. So as we're starting to see more expansion into community hospitals, we're also starting to see community clinics and their referral patterns and working around identifying patients and referring them to different sites. Having that expertise in US Oncology and understanding that quite nicely. And we have some real staunch advocates for cell and gene therapy in US Oncology for referrals to different sites of care and follow-up for care as well. So that's a huge asset. Another little known fact about McKesson is we also have a joint venture with the Sarah Cannon Research Institute. And in that joint venture, we engage in a lot of clinical trials in the cell and gene space. And the team there is really passionate about having access to all those clinical trials. So McKesson has some really unique assets that deployed specifically for cell and gene therapy can really allow patients to have more access to these groundbreaking therapies. And that's a lot about what McKesson is all about, is putting the patient first and helping them navigate the value chain to get access to these groundbreaking medications.
Absolutely. I think, you know, you and I were chatting, I can't remember at which conference, but about which led to you coming on to the podcast about our shared view and, you know, ORI's mission to enable widespread patient access to life-saving cell and gene therapies. Obviously, you know, having cures for cancer is great, but they need to be able to make it to patients. And that's the most important part. We also talked about when we were together, this idea of, you know, partnerships. So obviously ORI was partnered with Vannetti and other players in the space and is looking to partner with whoever that's interested in our shared mission, which McKesson certainly is. I wonder what your kind of view is around partnerships, their importance in the space, you know, what kinds of partnerships McKesson's actively thinking about, looking at, you know, vetting, kind of how are you thinking about those kinds of opportunities?
Yeah, it's always great to be at these conferences. We all see the same people that are advocates for the cell and gene ecosystem, right? And you and ORI have always been front and center and actually hosting and orchestrating a lot of that work. And I applaud you and the team there for doing that. And it's always great to participate. And because, listen, this is not an easy challenge to overcome. And we all need to work together to really allow for patients to have that access. And what I've always enjoyed about this space is it's not a lot of people, but it's people that are really focused and in a collegial manner to make sure that we're doing what's best for patients. And how we think about partnerships here at McKesson is we really have a well-defined partnership plan. And we're executing on that partnership plan with goals and objectives of, where in the ecosystem do we have, the cell and gene ecosystem, do we have gaps? We're not going, even a company the size of McKesson couldn't possibly do everything in this fragmented and large cell and gene ecosystem. Yep. So we have to make sure we're selecting like-minded partners that are focused on the same things we're focused on. And then really putting partnerships in place that help both parties. We want to make sure that our partners thrive as we're thriving in this space so that patients can thrive, right? So that's how we think about it. And we've really done an extensive ecosystem map of cell and gene therapy as part of our strategy work. Mm-hmm. And making sure we understand in each of those segments of the ecosystem, who are our preferred partners? How do we engage with them? Not only how does McKesson win, but how does the partner win and how do the patients win by us working together? That's sort of how we approach partnerships. It's important in this space more so than any other space I've worked in the 30 plus years. And I've been around the block a few times. It's and building these commercial organizations, you simply can't be everything to everybody. So you have to be choiceful and well thought out in how you develop your partnership network.
Absolutely. Is there anything that's public that you guys have done around the partnerships front, or, you know, kind of how you're thinking, any kind of tangible examples of how you're thinking about this in partnerships? I know you've got a lot of things you're working on behind the scenes, but has anything been announced yet?
Yeah. So we stay tuned. We've got some pretty cool ones coming.
Right.
You know, we're at a sprint for the Asembia meeting, which is a really big meeting. And I'm going to be chairing a panel on unique and innovative payment models in cell and gene therapy. Mm-hmm. And we're excited about that. But we're looking at the entire value chain, right? And the distribution and logistics, yeah, we absolutely have some core partnerships in distribution and logistics. Patient access, we're looking at how do we optimize patient access. You know, we have a company within McKesson that we use called Cover My Meds around copay assistance and other components. So we partner within our company and we partner externally as well. So we're always looking at ways in the patient journey and the product journey that where are the gaps And how do we need to layer in a partner there to really help us get over that gap? But we do have some pretty unique partnerships that we're getting ready, more on the, I would say, reimbursement and outcomes side of the business, as well as provider side of the business, provider enablement, because our strategy is built as a provider-aligned strategy. McKesson has a very large footprint in academic and community-based hospitals. Mm-hmm. We typically are their order processing, right? We're a known entity to them. They know how to order from us. And part of us building this industrialized standard for CGT to deliver the value chain is making sure that we have technology and partnerships that enables those providers to really have a streamlined effort to deliver care. Mm-hmm. And when you talk to someone and you do the market research, you can see the frustration is high and the concern is high, especially as they see the pipeline in cell and gene continue to evolve quickly with all these approvals.
I think we're layering complexity on top of complexity. You hear providers and clinicians complain about, you know, every product has its own portal. It's got its own process. It's all, you know, pretty opaque from their perspective. All they want to do is treat the patient and make it easy. And no one's quite cracked the nut on that yet, but it's great to hear that you guys are working on it.
Yeah, it's always interesting when you have conversations at conferences with administrators and clinicians, and they're starting to develop their own terminology for some of the challenges. Like when you hear like portal creep, and I'm like, that wasn't even in the lexicon.
That's right. It's not even a word, but it's fitting. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. So yeah, we're on that. We're trying to attack it in a problem solving fashion that will allow for a democratized or industrialized standard to deliver that.
I mean, one of the things, and I think you attended the workshop that we held last year, I think it was at the end of ARM on digitization, and we had a bunch of different stakeholders from the community there. And I wonder, you know, you talk about industrialization, certainly digital has to play a role, I think, in us getting to some sort of a scaled future that, you know, really opens up access and creates, you know, cost-effective medications that are affordable and accessible, not just kind of clinically approvable, which is what we continue to see coming to market. I wonder how do you feel, or maybe how does McKesson think about digital connected ecosystems? You know, what role do they have to play in your mind of to get to that that scaled future we all hope to achieve?
They're absolutely, for us to be successful, in my mind, there's zero doubt that there has to be a technology or a digitization component of it, right?
Yep.
And it has to be transparent to multiple stakeholders, to the providers, to the biopharma companies, to the payers, and ultimately to the patients and caregivers, right? And that you can't scale this business without it. That digitization component, that to me is the fiber that sort of woven throughout all this, right?
Yes.
So that to me is really important. And how we think about it here is there's some things that we're well positioned to build and do ourselves, but it needs to be, in my eyes, an extensive network of APIs and partnerships that generally available to connect with different data sets. I loved what you put together, that it was sort of a who's who right after ARM in cell and gene therapy. Not only was it great to see some old friends and colleagues, but we were tackling some of the challenging questions as sort of independent parties. And you did a great job of facilitating that meeting, and it was well worth my time and effort to go to those. I get invited to some, and some I attend and some I don't. And listen, it wasn't done in the eyes of one company. It was done in the eyes of the market. And how do we make progress?
Absolutely. And as you said, it's a multi-stakeholder question. You know, we had representatives from ARM there, you know, yourself. We had SAP there. We had Accenture there. We had a bunch of the startup companies that are active in this space. So it's really going to take an ecosystem approach to try and solve what today are very challenging logistical issues. I mean, as you said, digital is going to be the backbone. If we get this right, it has to be, because doing this on paper is just a non-starter. It just cannot happen. And we're trying to brute force these old school, you know, analog paper-based processes that it's just not working. So, you know, as you know, Ori is a cloud-native platform. We built it with that in mind. IoT, cloud-connected through API, we can hook into any system that has a similar characteristic, you know, has an API. And we want to be able to pass data to, you know, a McKesson system or a eBatch record or an MES or a data historian, or even to get, you know, direction from a manufacturing automation system like Ignition or Delta V, you know, this kind of seamless flow of data you know, electronic connection is, it's absolutely critical to get to scale. And, you know, what I fear is, you know, I think what we sort of landed on during that session was it's going to be an incremental process. It's going to be, you know, stepwise. The industry isn't pounding the table for this maybe right now because they've got bigger fish to fry. I don't know. There's other more acute challenges facing them. But we know this is you know, not too distant future. We have to solve this ahead of time before it becomes a problem. That was kind of one of my key takeaways from that discussion.
Yeah, and listen, nothing moves as quickly as you'd like it to move, right? Yeah. Especially in a space like this with the complexity that exists. But what I walk away from at those type of meetings is that we're identifying the challenge, and that's great. But now, as we evolve and we're at this sort of hockey stick of new commercial entrants into there, we need to get to solutioning, right? Yes. And that's one of the things I liked about the meeting is we started the beginnings of those solutioning. Mm-hmm. And that has to continue, whether it's through advisory groups or however it is, but it needs to be done interdisciplinary, and it needs to be done through a variety of key stakeholders who have the authority to make it happen, right? And that's how I think we get to an industrialized standard and how I think we get to scale in this space, which is really, really important.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think, you know, certainly the leadership of organizations like Arm, they've invited me to participate in a manufacturing workshop with the FDA on, you know, May 16th, 17th. You should try and come if you're not already planning on it. I think it'll be great to hear, you know, that there's like three tracks, one on distributed manufacturing, one on digital. And I forget what the other one is. It might be on market access, but I think it's, and I said to the folks at Arm, you know, Tim Hunt and the team, that I just don't want to sit in a room and complain about all the things that are the same, that are, you know, that are all the challenges that are facing the industry. I feel like we get into that trap at a lot of meetings. It has to be actionable. I mean, even if we start to set out a path for standards to say, okay, maybe we can't set standards now, but this is the framework we should think about it, or this is the road we need to travel, or here's what good looks like from a bunch of different industry participants, at least to help us chart the path. Because as you said, this can be a long road. We got to start walking. We got to start, you know, moving forward, and we'll figure it out as we move along, you know, from my perspective.
Yeah. And I think Tim and the Arm group is well positioned to do that. I'm a bit biased as I sit on their value and access subcommittee. Mm-hmm. Of the 15 or so executives that was invited to sit on that. And there's some weighty issues there. There's some weighty issues in manufacturing. How does it all come together, right? Because it's already a fragmented healthcare system to begin with, right? Cell and gene therapy is fragmented, but how do we put all the pieces together? And I think where Arm sits, they can see all the pieces and help to put all that together. So I'm a big fan, and I always try to participate in those meetings because it's a vehicle, I think, where we can make a difference.
And I think the regulator has been very open to industry input and collaboration. And, you know, Peter Marks and the team seem to be very open to participating in these kinds of discussions that helps, you know, hopefully move the needle forward, which hasn't always been the case. I've been in biopharma for about 25 years, and I didn't always feel there was an open door at the FDA, but I think under Peter's leadership, you know, CBER's really been out in front and trying to collaborate, be open, you know, regulatory innovation, you know, bringing some new thinking to this, you know, very particular challenge for cell therapy.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think Peter and the team have been great. It's been refreshing to see the solutions approach and hiring of people and really committing to the space. I think they see the unbelievable science coming through. And now the next step is where we have manufacturing challenges that we're overcoming. We have value and access challenges that we're overcoming. Because listen, the science is fantastic. And these companies getting the products approved is great. The next hurdle is how do we make these products commercially valuable, right? That's an important hurdle we have to attack.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I've had a lot of conversations this year, you know, starting at JP Morgan early in January about, you know, commercial viability, as I call it, which I think dovetails along exactly the line you just said. Commercial viability is one of the screens we have to think about during R&D, you know, during process development. If we create a product that, you know, has an extremely high price and a very low volume, you know, highly variable manufacturing process, can't get market access, you know, it's fourth or fifth line therapy. All of these things are inhibiting certainly patient access, but also, you know, might be a signal that the development process isn't quite done yet. You know, what if we could take a bit more time early in the process to create a more accessible product, you know, one that we can make at a higher volumes, one that maybe the cost of goods are lower. You know, I think, you know, you and I grew up in small molecules and biologics. You know, we never had a cost of goods in our TPP, right? Our target product profile. You know, that's just not something we had to worry about. But now it is, you know, with these advanced therapies, we need to be thinking about, you know, what's our cost of manufacturing? What's our cost to get to the patient? How many patients do we want to treat? How big is the indication? And these are somewhat unique, but that has to happen early, because when it happens too late, you know, we get some of the issues that we've seen, you know, recently, where we have products that can't really make it to patients at scale. You know, it can't be manufactured. The supply chain challenges that, you know, a lot of the first generation CAR-Ts have faced or have been widely publicized. And I think, you know, we need to take those lessons. We need to bring them back with us into preclinical development.
Yeah. And when you sit where I sit at McKesson, the beauty of being at McKesson rather than in one of my old jobs as the chief commercial officer of a biotech company is I get to help a lot of different companies with a lot of different assets. And because we have clinical resources like SCRI and US, you get to talk to people at these companies at different phases of their evolution of their product. Mm. And the ones that are thinking commercially, like you said, early, you can tell by the questions they ask and the approaches they're taking versus the ones that are like, hey, our pivotal is going to read out and we need to start thinking about our 3PL and should we do title model, non-title model? Joe, can you and the team help us? Absolutely, we can help you with that. But thinking about the commercialization process as you're designing some of the pivotal work really helps you, especially with what Peter and the FDA have said about long-term follow-up, right? Mm-hmm. And really making sure you're monitoring, measuring the right endpoints so that you could also navigate the payer environment in the future around value-based care, right? So all this comes together, right, in this. You sort of have to take all this calculus into effect, right? As you're solving the equation, because you just can't jump in. Like when we were doing small molecules, yeah, you got your market access plan like 8 to 12 months before you're ready to launch. Now you need to engage a lot earlier in thinking about the value and access component. And it's just the fact of being doing this for 30 plus years, you see the evolution of it. And you're right. The first time I learned about COGS in this industry was when I was at Dendreon. I'm like, oh, this is different than biologics. No doubt.
Yeah, I think Dendreon is oft quoted as, you know, that was the canary in the coal mine, or the first indication that this is different than the ballgame that we've been playing for decades with small molecules and large molecules.
Yep.
Just to kind of hone in on that one point, reinforce the point you mentioned about the FDA, I think, you know, the recent guidance where they suggested, I've got it here in front of me so I don't mess up the exact phraseology, but it was, we recommend that any extensive manufacturing changes be introduced prior to initiating clinical studies that are intended to provide evidence of safety and effectiveness in support of a BLA. That's pretty direct feedback for the industry, but also pretty unusual because I think you and I both know that's not really how we operate today. You know, the plan is still to tweak and change our process. There's even a shorthand joke about how actually PD starts when you hit the clinic because we're finally using patient material and we realize how good or not our processes are and we've got to go from there. So I think taking the time, you know, before you get too deep into the clinical process to really examine your manufacturing, your supply chain, your path to market, your cost of goods, all of those pieces, it makes a lot of sense. And it's an investment that will pay off, you know, pay dividends. I think when we neglect that and we think, oh, we just got to rush and get that safety signal or that efficacy signal is when we really run into problems, you know, later in the track, you know, pivotal trial, post-pivotal, upon approval, when we really run into some of the challenges we've seen with some of those, you know, first generation therapies.
Yeah. Time challenges, money challenges, and then just and morale challenges, quite frankly, for the teams.
Yeah. 100%. 100%. We talked a little bit about digital as one of the technologies we'd like to see, you know, coming to the fore and we think is critical. Are there any other kind of emerging technologies you're keeping your eye on or trends that you'd like to see come to market that you think will improve manufacturing, supply chain, accessibility, you know, for CGTs?
Yeah, we talked about there's a couple actually as I think about our strategy, right? And I'm taking this from the provider viewpoint, right? The folks that are on the ground giving these groundbreaking medications on a day-to-day basis. We've have a clinical advisory council that helps McKesson develop its strategy and understand how we deliver this. And in talking to those folks, some of the challenges are we've made progress in manufacturing, right? Different companies manufacture differently, right? But the consistency of an ordering portal that's familiar and common to people is one thing, but also slot management and availability and how can they slot the appropriate patient? And I want more than one or two in a month, those type approaches. We've made progress and we'll continue to make progress, but how do we streamline all that information for the clinicians is something that's needed. And I think there's some viable options that will be hitting the market that can help there. And then the outcomes tracking work. The FDA has talked about a period for follow-up, long-term mm-hmm. follow-up. You know, the uniqueness of you spend, there's a cost density issue in cell and gene, right? So it's a lump sum. And then it doesn't sort of go well with the U.S. payer system where you see the value over a five-year period. So the government has recommended that a 15-year follow-up for many of these medications. So how are we going to do that? And do we do it on paper? Probably not the most efficient. Yeah, a digital technology platform to do this is probably optimal. And so we don't have a lot of patients that are lost to follow up. And how do you sort of make sure you can follow that patient from the academic center to the community, back to their home? And all that comes into play. But that needs to happen. And I think technology and a very extensive and well-orchestrated API connections will help because that's going to be tough for one player to do on their own.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we've talked to some players in the kind of longitudinal data collection space to say, actually, that kind of data, because right now when you're manufacturing, you're in the black box, right? You have very limited access to data other than what happens in the manufacturing suite. So the way we measure good is, was the product released or not? You know, did it hit spec or not? And it's a very kind of binary one or zero outcome. But actually, it doesn't tell you anything about how did the patient respond? You know, how did they do after post-infusion? How was it? Was it clinically effective or not? And actually, that kind of data could be really useful in adapting manufacturing processes to make medicines more clinically effective. You know, you can imagine, you know, we're seeing, you know, when you were talking about access and slots and providers. We were down at MD Anderson at CTMC, our partners down in Houston last Monday. And they were talking about, you know, some of the challenges that they have with existing cell therapies and just, you know, getting the data to potentially adapt our manufacturing protocols to make these medicines either more durable or more potent or both, you know. And, you know, we were seeing in the runs that we did with them a greater population of naive phenotype of T cells. We're sort of exploring why that might be. You know, there's all these things that are happening with these living medicines. And, you know, a lot of it has to do with the health and situation of the patient when their cells are harvested and put into the process. But if we could see, you know, how they do post-infusion potentially in a blinded fashion, no one needs any, you know, patient-specific data, we could actually learn a lot about what good looks like in manufacturing and to try and get more, maybe you move the specification to a place that gets a more clinically effective medication. There's all kinds of possibilities, but right now it's a complete black box. It goes into some EMR somewhere in some hospital or some patient's, you know, paper record and is lost. So I think you're absolutely right that that kind of linked up digital record or digital data flow will help us do our job so much better. You know, even parts of the value chain that are seemingly disconnected, actually, you know, if they were connected digitally, we could have, there could be a lot of value there for patients and providers.
No doubt. And not an easy feat to tackle, no. Right? And look, even where we sit, and McKesson is fortunate because we sit in a unique position in the value chain where we know when the product commercially or clinically was delivered, right? Mm-hmm. So we have that right now. That starts the journey of how do we track outcomes and how do we tokenize it in a way where we can track it longitudinally from the academic or community hospital back to the community practitioner who's doing the follow-up. And then at the right time, report it at a 5-year, 10-year, and 15-year interval. And what are you reporting? Are you reporting avoidance of other medications, of side effects? What exactly is the outcome? And all that, by the way, needs to, as you said to your earlier point, be decided as they're developing some of the pivotal clinical work, right? Yes. So it all comes together, but it will really be a joint effort of multiple partners in the ecosystem working towards that, is my personal opinion of how that will work.
Yeah, I 100% agree for sure. And we've taken that ecosystem approach from the very beginning. We're coming to the end of our time together. And thanks again so much for spending an hour with us. I like to ask my guests to kind of dust off their crystal balls. I'm sure you got one under your desk there somewhere. And tell me what you see. What do you see in the 5 to 10 year time frame? You know, what does good look like? You know, what's the path for us to really to get to widespread patient access, which I think is really the goal for all of us that work in this industry?
So whenever I think about the future, I always think about where we've been. And the unbelievable science is just tremendous. This is the stuff of science fiction many years ago, which for a guy who's scientifically curious like me is just so cool. I really get excited by it. I'm really pleased with the work we've done in some of the hematologic malignancies and the rare diseases. But boy, you start seeing some of the autoimmune disease data that's coming out. And that is really exciting in large patient populations. Listen, I got off the plane at ASH this year in San Diego, and my phone had blown up from the approval of 2 sickle cell products by the FDA on the same day, so which was groundbreaking, right? So more approvals are coming. Everything's really exciting. As we move into these larger patient populations, we're really going to have our ecosystem infrastructure set. We're going to need to make progress towards that digital technology that you talk about. Yep. To be able to make sure that all the stakeholders understand how this value chain scales. And for me, what I think really excites me about the future is the fact that future generations will have access to groundbreaking medications that without that, they would not have lived full lives. Mm-hmm. I am absolutely blown away by the work the scientists are doing in these pharma companies and biotech companies. It's unbelievable. Now it's up to the value chain and manufacturing executives like you and I to really make sure that we can get those products to the right patients at scale. So that way they can have access to these products outside of a clinical trial. And I hope, what I hope is that the commercial work continues to evolve and that these commercially valuable products are funded by the appropriate folks at the appropriate level. So that way companies that are emerging biotechs and mid-sized pharma companies and even large pharma companies can thrive and continue the science. Because if we don't get to that commercial success and viability, I don't know that we'll ever get to the next level.
Yeah, 100% agree with that. And I'll just call attention as a final kind of call out to say that, you know, there's a call to action there for partnerships amongst enabling technology providers, manufacturing providers, supply chain logistics, like for this infrastructure around this incredible science has to mature and has to develop quickly so that we can make sure that all those patients get access who need it. And not only in the Western world, but all over the world. And I think your point is very well taken. And a big thank you to you for your time today and for educating us about all the interesting things that McKesson is doing in the space.
Always great to spend time with you, Jason. I enjoy it and look forward to seeing you live and in person sometime soon.
Thanks, Joe.
Thanks, buddy.
Thank you for listening to the Ori Spotlight Podcast. To keep up with the latest in cell and gene therapy and follow us on our mission to manufacture brighter futures for patients, head to the show notes to follow us on social media or visit us at oribiotech.com.